I want to introduce Alan Prussian, our speaker today. Alan is the managing director of Vantage Point, a management consulting company. As a behavioral analyst with over 25 years of sales and management experience, Alan works with executives to build high-impact teams by helping them identify and select top performers in improving team dynamics and effectiveness, and to train sales and management professionals to increase effectiveness. With that said, I present Alan.
So thank you. So I called Jim when about a month ago and said, what are we trying to accomplish here? Because what I've learned is that, to me, my commitment is to deliver value to you. It's not about me just coming up and doing a presentation. So I made the decision of having no PowerPoints because I personally believe that PowerPoints become a crutch for people, and they focus on the slides or the PowerPoints, and they don't focus on their audience. So my objective here today is to focus on you, us, as a group of individuals, and talk about sales and what I like to call sales mastery. So that said, this is not going to be a monologue. This is going to be a conversation. I'm going to ask questions. Everybody here has had experience in what we're talking about in some way, shape, or form, and I would like input to those conversations. And I'm pretty patient, so if you don't respond, we'll wait. So, all right? So by show of hands, how many of you have made your living as a salesperson independent of you ever being a consultant? So before you were a consultant in some way, shape, or form, you were a commissioned salesperson, okay, to make a living. You're living, well, not commission only, but a significant piece of your income came from commission. Okay, a smaller sampling here, about three or four people. All right, I bring that up because as consultants, we're all selling, right? And yet, only a handful of us actually have that sales experience. So how do we increase our effectiveness in selling when we really haven't been in sales, right? The first thing I will share with you is that I would suggest that you go get more information about being a top salesperson, and hopefully you'll get some of that here. But there's a number of terrific training programs, and why I say that is because people who sell for a living, that is their expertise, right? So we're trying to do part-time what they do full-time. Because our expertise is really the services that you all announced when you introduced yourself. It's not selling, necessarily. All right? So I would encourage you to do that, to get involved in that. Let's start by answering the question, what are some of the challenges you face in sales?
The introduction.
What do you mean by the introduction?
Just getting some favorable attention, meeting people, either the cold call or networking, just being able to say hi.
Okay, so
I guess it's lead generation.
So is that lead generation what you're asking, what you're saying?
Or is no, not necessarily.
Okay. And lead generation, right?
Mm-hmm. I would add that qualifying the lead so you don't waste your time.
Moving past hello.
Moving past what?
Hello.
Moving past hello.
Keeping them on the phone long enough to do that.
Okay. Well, first of all, qualification. Tell me a little bit more about qualification. What do you mean by that?
In terms of, there are a lot of organizations that would like to have the services that you use, but can either afford you, or they're just talking and to learn from you. So being sure that they're serious, they have a budget for you, and doing that in a graceful way so you don't end up writing a 200-page proposal when they have no intention of using you. So qualifying the lead is someone who's serious about using you.
So how might you determine if someone's using you for a 200-page proposal and they're not serious about using you?
Well, one of the things that I've learned over the years back when I was in sales, don't waste your time on writing a 200-page proposal if you don't already have a connection or a contact inside the company that wants you to propose or ask for your input about how to do that, because writing the proposal can be, you know, a cold call proposal is very little value for the time that it takes. The other thing that I've had is also asking people about, you know, what is your budget for this? When do you want to do this? Or are you just thinking about it? I'm a little uncomfortable. I've been on both sides of it, asking what is your budget for this.
Thanks for sharing that.
I'm looking for some other ways to qualify other than the obvious.
Okay. Any other challenges?
Yeah. I do a lot of cold calling. And the question I have is, how do you find out what their hot button is? What is their interest that you can supply?
Okay, any other challenges?
I think you have to focus on, it's not only what their pain might be, but what your products are you're selling. It's too easy to...
Is that a challenge?
Yeah, it's a challenge.
It's a challenge to focus on your products.
Not that you don't want to be everything to everybody.
All right, any other challenges?
Getting over objections.
Getting over objections? Okay.
Maintaining contact when you're either finished with the project or they've said no.
So maintaining contact after they've said no?
Yeah, maintaining contact in a graceful way.
Okay. You had your, I'll get you there next, Dave.
It's a long selling cycle.
Yeah.
Long cycle. Good take. 2 years. I was going to say 18 months,
and then 18 months or longer.
You know, closing the deal.
Okay, Dave?
That's what I was going to say. Asking for the sale.
Yeah.
Probably the easiest to know to do and the hardest to do.
I was just reading a blog on LinkedIn about the issue of what consultants are doing by offering to do something for free.
Right.
And there was some interesting pros and cons of how that was hurting the industry as well as where it might be of some value. So I would be interested in hearing your experience about offering for free. I haven't done that, and would just be curious about that.
One of the other ones that that I've seen is getting past the gatekeepers.
Oh, yeah.
And the other one is actually delivering your value prop in as short a possible time. All right, and then you said delivering
value.
Yeah, delivering your value proposition quickly.
30 seconds.
Yeah, what we like to call fire and forget.
And are you talking about in a sales meeting or on the telephone introduction?
This is literally just the intro.
Okay.
Yep. Because the problem is I've been on the other side. So the other side is I didn't want to spend time with salespeople unless they could somehow enrich me. So I either had a gatekeeper or I would have people walking on up to me and going, why in heaven's name should I hire you or work with you? Because there's like 63 others out there just like you.
That's right.
Okay. So actually, that's another challenge, which is differentiation, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's where, for me, delivering the value proposition, proposition for me is differentiation of you from your competitors. What is it that I'm going to provide you as a value that the others can't?
Okay.
You also said quickly, and so it's getting that 30-second attention on that delivering value.
Like the elevator pitch.
The elevator pitch, but...
One thing we've been working on is selling based upon value we bring as opposed to price and negotiation.
Okay. So what's the challenge? Is there a specific challenge?
The challenge is that once you get the price, you just become a commodity.
Okay.
Once you get the negotiation, they don't understand the value.
So the challenge is selling value.
Selling value. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I would suggest that in our current economic times, it probably becomes even more challenging, right? Because people are more price sensitive today than they were just 2 years ago. All right.
And so there's one other that I just want to, and this is a conversation Jim and I have had before, with regards to making sure that the value that you know you're bringing is actually being compensated for correctly. Let me see if I can say that in a different way. These days I'm running into a lot of consultants that are looking at me going, well, with the economy as bad as it is, I've actually cut my prices. And my comment to them is, hey, I have a horrible comment for you. You'd be shocked at the amount of corporate execs that look at you and say the value you bring to the table is now diluted because you're too cheap.
Right.
I only want to hire that. So it's almost like, you know, what's the value you bring for the price you're, you know, you're requesting?
So the challenge is pricing. How do I price my services, right?
In particularly in the economy.
Yep.
While preserving value.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Any other last challenges? Okay, so now let's look at.
Of course. Well, when you look at that long list, I would say maybe staying motivated so you can address all
the. That's good. That's
good. Thus, consulting for the meetings.
Staying motivated, very good.
And wine.
Exactly. That's why we have all these meetings with alcohol. All right. So there are a lot of challenges here that we could easily look at and say, oh, my God, it's really hard to lift this thing, you know, with all these staring us in the face, right? So, but you're all successful in some way, shape, or form, correct? So let's think about what you're doing that works. Okay. As a salesperson of your services or products, what are you doing today that works?
What I do is one of my kind of that thing that you fell into, luckily, was that I knew early on in my career that I had to get out there and network as much as possible. So
okay.
I actually presented all over the world on the stuff that I consider myself an expert on. So now whenever I go to a conference, you know, I make sure people know I'm a consultant, and if they have any questions, I get the chance to show them that I know what I'm talking about, and I can actually generate leads from those conferences.
Okay, so a combination of networking and speaking.
Yep.
Excellent.
I would also say publishing, not only in magazines, but also it can be in LinkedIn or some of the blogs that are where our clients would be looking.
Great. Publishing, what other things do you do today that is working?
Well, one of the things I accept is that the sales cycle is going to take some time.
Mm-hmm.
So my approach usually is to make them a friend. You know, build the relationship first. Let them understand who I am and what I do. And understand what they do. And not just to jump right into a selling mode.
Okay, we're going to come back to this one. All right, anything else?
Referrals from not only networking, from prior clients.
Okay, so you're asking for referrals. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
The one thing that I've found consistently works and that I was always looking for is basically focusing on what's in it for them.
Ah, great. Mm-hmm. Focus on the customer.
And I'll add to that, I mean, it kind of piggybacks that, but it's like, know your success stories in your head so that when you're having a conversation with somebody, you can say, oh my gosh, just did a project, so and so and such, you know, that is so akin to that, you know, and then you draw them into the conversation comfortably by bringing a third party into it.
Okay, yes.
Also, as part of the customer piece, is understanding the customer. If you're working with different industries and different businesses, as I am, you don't walk into a meeting without learning as much as you can about the industry, the customer, what their challenges are. So you can pick the right success stories and ask them some really good questions.
Correct. And with the internet, this has gotten exponentially easier, right? I mean, getting industry. And when we talk about challenges, we talk about industry challenges, right? Yes, Jim.
I take time to meet with one or two people a week to have breakfast or lunch with. I've done it with several people. in this room and with other organizations and try to understand their business and where they want to go, because I found that, you know, in trying to help them down the road, that actually will help expand where you want to get. And I've been able to, after having lunch with a few people or breakfast, been able to give them referrals through, say, other than customers, just people that I know out there that had a need for their particular service.
Perfect.
Yes. Yeah, I'd like to expand on that point. I think a lot of the thing, lead generation and all that, is certainly going to be different depending upon your consulting. But where our success is really based more upon communicating to other service providers, whether they be banks, the legal profession, real estate brokers. We're kind of in a business where referrals happen. That does happen. But, you know, we're getting into a situation where there's some sort of trouble. And sometimes the people that are in that trouble want to keep that relatively quiet. So 3 years later, if they're now successful, they may be happy to say, yeah, we hired GFO, and, you know, we're pleased with what they did. But 6 months after you're out of there, it's still pretty quiet. So, you know, a lot of what we do is focus on talking to people who have relationships with potential customers,
okay,
rather than try to go direct, because the cold calling is tough in our business. Lead generation is, you know, we do it, of course. But so I think dealing with other providers or other entities is kind of key for us.
We call those centers of influence, right? And they can have influence for a variety of reasons. I have a cousin who worked for the largest accounting firm in Canada, but he works on the consulting side, and they do a lot of workouts for financially troubled companies. And they get all their business from the banks, right? Banks are invested in those businesses, and they're going to bring my cousin and his partners in to resolve issues because they got a vested interest. In this case, they got a serious center of influence over the owners. And the owners, and I'm sure it happens in your business as well, are probably, you know, in a certain level of denial, right? So they're going to put it off as long as possible, sure, bringing them that third party in. But that may apply for some of our businesses and not for others. Yeah.
I think, and somebody mentioned it earlier, LinkedIn, but I think social networking is key nowadays. I've had 2 signed contracts off of LinkedIn and several off of my website.
Great.
And to that point, actually, and I think it also goes back to success stories and testimonials, if you can get people to refer you in LinkedIn and talk about what a great job you did and the job that you were doing, that's also something that really helps a lot from an IT perspective or new technology.
Okay? Yes.
This relates to some degree. Is what are you doing to really make that friend and reinforce it? I know that Jim has talked about lunch. I think a lot of people are taking shortcuts because of LinkedIn and other things. And I'll give you a for instance. When Villanova looked at where our customers come from, it certainly is parents, but it's also the counselors in the high school. So they started a Villanova event where they invite key career counselors from high schools to come here, and they even fly them in and spoil the heck out of them. I mean, you know, just lavish them with love, as well as information entering the campus and all that. But it may be worth it to think, who do you need to love? I mean, who do you really need to say thank you to? Is it more than lunch?
And you're tying this back to the center of influence, right?
So these absolutely. Are the people. They're in the center of influence, but there's certain people that you just need to love some more. I mean, just not, you know, send them a Christmas card. You need to really be nice. Right. Really nice.
But this is not rubbing up against them.
So, it's more than a marketing brochure.
Gotcha.
Appropriately.
Okay.
To piggyback upon it, that's pretty key, because all too often what we fail to do is we fail to recognize that these folks have things going on too. And a lot of times my business basically comes from, I put A and B together. And I got creative. And in fact, I just did something in the last 2 weeks. It's like, this guy has one expertise, this guy has a complementary expertise, and another guy has another complementary. I put together a triangle, put them all together, and they're developing a business partnership. And if you get creative like that, and you probably got in your customer base folks that have complementary skills, that would like to partner with other people, get creative, put them together, and it works. And then you get the
thing. The other thing that's interesting, too, is to share the newest cutting-edge technology with people.
Okay.
And it creates what the Japanese call giri, which is obligation. So you don't charge them anything, but they come to, you know, look at you as somebody that has improved them and made them better, and you establish obligation with them to possibly work with you for the future.
State-of-the-art stuff.
Yep.
So this is kind of sharing information or expertise. Maybe going back a little bit to the comment you made, which was giving something away for free. Okay.
But different in that regard. You're not actually giving the expertise. You're sharing knowledge that you can find doing some of the work they've already done.
Okay.
How about bringing in additional business where you're with a customer, upselling within a client that you already have business with?
So you're having success upselling?
Yeah.
Okay.
Better go in cheap. Get them up.
Okay. Any others? I mean, we could probably go on for a long time, which we won't, but if there's anything that's burning or pressing, I'd love to hear it.
One other thing I think you have to be careful of is when you talk about understanding the industry and the customer, you don't want to go too far like you know a lot about it. You want to be able to continue to what I call the done consultant approach.
Mm-hmm.
When you ask questions and you get them involved and you get them hooked, it's good to have some industry background, but don't go too much because then you know you almost come off like you know better than they do. So you want to be careful about that.
Yeah, I think those questions.
You're asking good questions, right? So,
yeah.
Right.
And actually, I wrote questions. It really should be good questions.
Yeah.
Okay. And many of you are experts in your field, and I don't think you shouldn't be the expert in your field. I think what you're suggesting is don't come across as the expert in the field. It's kind of a know-it-all. But someone who, and the truth is, I mean, I'm working on a joint venture between some professors that have intellectual property around innovation from Wharton and Columbia. And, you know, we're putting them in front of customers. And obviously, this is what these people eat, sleep, and breathe in their life, right? But yet, what we do is we talk about what's happening as it relates to innovation at the customer so we can understand what their unique challenges are. Okay, because I can't solve their challenges if I don't really understand what they are, because it's not like a simple approach is going to work for everybody.
Okay. Plus, some of those customers don't really know what they need, and unless you ask them questions to really get down, almost like the Ishikawa concept of the root cause, what's
right.
the root here, and why am I really being called in?
Right.
The questions are absolutely essential.
Yeah, and
that actually goes right back then to one of the challenges over here is to identify their hot button. Because you can, like, I mean, I think that these are going hand in hand. You know, on the good side, it's like you're really good at asking the questions once you're in the door, but then how do you get in the door to be able to get to those places? Or once you have the contract, then you're in asking all these wonderful questions to get the upsell and so forth. So I think that kind of these really go on tandem.
Well, you know, it's funny, it helps when you're from New Jersey because everybody from New Jersey and New York always starts out every comment with a question. Let me ask you something.
Yeah, I think sort of an overriding comment here is that, you know, you talk about sales experience and sort of opened with that, and I think sales experience is—it's really two buttons. I mean, we talk about, you know, the hot button. That's a good analogy, but it's two buttons. One is the content of the work, but the other is the individual, the decision making. So even when you talk about sharing, you know, asking questions or not, presenting yourself as an expert or not, I've sat across a client where the best thing for me to do is tell that client every single thing I know about his industry, because that's what that client wants to hear. The next day, I might have a meeting with somebody who doesn't want to hear anything about what I know about his industry. It's a personality thing. So I think, you know, part of it is when you actually get into communication with the person, the key part of the selling is perhaps not the work. It's really, is this the decision maker? What makes them tick? What do they need? And really, what's the approach? How do you approach that person? I don't know. You probably have all of that in that list somewhere.
Well, we do and we don't.
I
mean,
that's very, very
I captured
important.
What you said, which is know your customer, right? Mm-hmm. We're all different. okay, and what we need from a consultant slash salesperson is different,
right,
even though the challenge may be the same, okay? It's an important distinction.
But you actually kind of hit a salient point there, is that they're buying you.
Right.
They can, anybody, you know, we all got pretty much the same toolbox,
right?
With some way, shape, or form. But they really are buying you.
Yeah. And one guy might want the arrogant me, which I can do, or one person might want, you know, the complacent me, which I can also do. And it doesn't matter about, it's not really my skill set. I'm going to do the same work, perhaps, for both of those clients, although no assignments are exactly the same. But it really is, what's the relationship with that decision maker? And that's really important. And I think that distinguishes you. And if you get that person comfortable, then the dollars flow. You're not talking too much about per hour, per day, you know.
The price, right.
Yeah, you're talking about, I'm bringing value, that's been discussed. I'm bringing value. We get along, you know, we'll hit it off. I know what you want. You sort of have established that, and, you know, I'm real expensive.
Well, the other thing that links, the other thing that links to that, too, is also the culture of the company. You're looking at the culture of the person you're talking to, and you're looking at the culture of the company. And in some cases, when you're going globally, you're looking at the culture of the country. In Japan, you know, you'd be surprised at who makes the decisions. It's actually a team approach. And some corporations can actually be that way. You may not be talking to the key decision maker, but are you talking to an influencer? And the bottom line is, it really goes back to know your customer and your company and figure out, you know, are you really, you know, and it may even go into some of the stuff we're going to talk about here. You're looking at body language, you're looking at the way they're asking the questions, you know, all these key things.
So let me present to you.
I think we've talked about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Solutions. Come from the pharmaceutical industry, and we were taught to sell going in with having a solution. You know, they almost tell you that, but that's what it was. And I think as consultants especially, and in 2009 especially, you have to go in, because we talked about questions, I think you have to go in really asking the historical perspective of what's going on before, and get all the information you need before you offer that solution. So while it's important to have one in mind, you have to depend, it goes back to what the gentleman said too, depending on who your customer is, too, you have to really think, let me try to withhold as long as I can that solution until I'm absolutely sure what's going on.
Who's familiar with Stephen Covey's Seven Habits? What's number five?
Seek first to understand?
Seek first to understand and then to be understood. That's exactly what you're talking about.
Good job.
Okay, thank you. And that's what you just described, right? Taking the time to really understand what's happening over there. And that's what you were describing. Now, there's complexity to that, obviously, because you start to deal with the individual, not just the organization, right? But it really, I always say, let me ask you a question. In a court of law, if you were on the witness stand, who's doing most of the talking, you or the lawyer?
The lawyer.
You.
You are. Why?
You're talking about a standard court of law?
Well, if it's a criminal trial.
Well, it's based on the questions you're asked. I listened to a coaching tape years ago, and it's stuck with me to this day. Throughout this eight cassettes, remember those? Eight cassettes. Throughout it, this gentleman kept talking about the person in control of a conversation is the one asking the question. And I never thought about that before. Like that. And I'm in sales and communication.
There you go. So who's been pulled over by a cop?
Yeah.
Who does most of the talking? You do.
Yeah.
Who's asking the questions?
The cop is.
The cop is. Do you realize how fast you were going? Are you in a rush? Where are you trying to get to? You know, they're asking a lot of questions, and you're the one doing all the talking. Okay, sales is the same thing. As you so eloquently said, the person asking the questions is the person in control. Who's in control of this meeting?
Yes.
Me, but am I doing most of the talking?
No,
because I chose that this model that I'm comfortable with is that I'm going to ask questions and we're going to pull information. because there's brilliance in the room far in excess of what I have in my head. Okay? And I can't find it out if I don't ask questions. Okay? So the number, we talk about this success of asking good questions, but that's critical in the sales process. So let me present you to the last time or times plural that you made a major purchase. I don't care if it was a car, you had to replace your roof, your air conditioning system, you know, you actually bought a house. Doesn't matter. Think of a major purchase that you made. Okay, everybody got something in mind? Major purchase. Now let's assume, well, it's not a safe assumption, but did you get multiple quotes? The houses is kind of a little challenging on that, but you know, if you were doing like work in your house, like redoing your kitchen or something, did you get multiple quotes? Okay. So did you select the person or organization you selected, why did you select them?
Quality of work.
The quality of their work. How did you know the quality of their work?
Saw previous work.
Okay. So quality was important to you, and you dialed into that, and it was based upon your observation. You actually went and saw the quality of the workmanship somewhere else. Okay? Any others?
Past relationships.
So you did business with somebody that you had previously done business with. How did you...
actually knew them. So.
But you hadn't done business with them. It was a personal relationship.
Right.
Okay, so how is that personal relationship? Is there a risk of doing that?
Absolutely.
Okay. But why did you choose to risk it?
Husband did.
Now the truth comes out.
I was going to say, how did it work out?
It turned out well.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. Why do you think your husband chose this person?
It was purely a relationship.
Purely, you think?
Yeah.
Okay. Any others? Yes.
With me, it was that they knew the product. They had an expertise.
Okay.
And they gained my trust by knowing.
They gained your trust because they could demonstrate to you that they knew the product or whatever you were getting better than whomever else you had spoken with.
Mine was a response to questions.
Okay, so what was the response that...
Well, I did an initial screening based on the proposal scope of work.
Right.
And then when I saw the scope of work plus the price, the price was lower, the scope of work was broader than the other proposals. So I wanted to make sure that within that scope of work, certain issues were being addressed because they weren't all listed.
So basically, and this is a great comment because what you just said to me, if I understood you correctly, is having the lowest price hurt the vendor because you had a concern that they weren't going to deliver everything that you wanted.
It didn't hurt the vendor.
Well, it had the potential to.
Brought the vendor to the top of the pile.
Okay.
But allowed him the opportunity to answer my questions and put those answers in writing.
Okay. But he could have messed up because if he had under-promised in the proposal, it would have taken him out of the running quickly,
exactly.
Even though it brought him to the top of the pile.
His proposal scope was broader.
Okay.
Which is interesting.
Yes.
Yes.
Someone that gave me more information than I knew to ask for.
So back to what we said earlier, they educated you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So how many times did you buy what you were buying?
Most of my purchases are like that when people do that.
Right. Mm-hmm. But like when I bought a roof, how many times do I buy roofs in my life? It was the first time I ever bought a roof. What do I know about buying roofs?
Right.
Okay? Clearly the contractor should know a heck of a lot more about it than me. And he should be willing, in some way, shape, or form, to educate me in a way that delivers value before I ever give him my money or sign on the dotted line. Okay? There's value in that. Okay? What do I interpret when someone does that? How did you feel about the individual?
You know, there's a higher level of competence and confidence that you tend to have when someone takes that time, especially to do that.
Okay.
But can I ask that? I mean, I agree with that totally, and I mean, I'm an educator, so of course I'm like, you know, you're preaching to the choir, educate, educate, educate. But going back to the problem over here, how far is too much? If you're educating them for free and they haven't paid for anything, how do you find where the stopping line is?
I'm using the analogy only because it's relevant in my mind. I bought in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, a roof, a heating system, an air conditioning system. I'm currently in the process of redoing our kitchen, you know, going through that whole process. You know, those are all big purchases, you know. Cars, you know, to me is not a big purchase because I only buy used cars and I have a whole system model. I never walk into a deal. I haven't walked into a dealership and bought a car my whole life. I've never done it. I've done it once, actually. Did it once in my life. So that I take out of the equation altogether because I understand that business because I used to be in it and I know how to manipulate the business, okay? So not manipulate it, but make it work to my advantage, actually. So I think what no one said, but was, yeah, go ahead.
I got a new roof not long ago.
Okay.
And I went completely on the referral of a neighbor.
Completely?
Completely.
But what is your relationship with the neighbor?
I completely trusted this neighbor. I know what sort of person he is. I know the work that he put behind making his decision, and I piggybacked on that.
So you wouldn't have done the level of due diligence that he would have done, but you knew.
I only do, actually.
Ah, okay. But you decided it wasn't important because if he did it, it's good enough for me.
Yeah.
In fact, he would do it better than I would do it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, back to the question here. I don't know if you ever really stop to educate, but you don't deliver certain service. For instance, when we talk about like personal leadership, we educate them about what that means. But you know, it's a real simple process. You set a goal, you identify the obstacles, you find a solution, you set a date to get over it. The one thing to tell them all that, it's one thing to develop that skill within them to do
right.
that.
Execution is always, the details are in the execution.
That's right.
Absolutely.
If you continue to educate, that's okay. They'll appreciate it. Then you can get to the execution.
But the bottom line with education is that these people are looking out for you. Here's where I come from. I come from a world where I dealt with vendors all the time. And in the world of pharma and biotech, you better hit your timelines because every day you're late costs the company ranging from $500 million, you know, in different directions. So what's amazing is that if I had a vendor turn to me and say, not a problem, we can do it, then I was already worried. If, on the other hand, he turned to me and he said, hey, you know, you got to be careful because if you're going into Canada, by the way, Canada is now expecting you to keep track of the temperature of this shipment, even though it's not even refrigerated, it's just RT. Or watch out when you're going into Japan because they're going to need this. Now, this guy's looking out for me. And now I feel, you know, kind of a kinship, a connection, a trust establishing, and even obligation. And now I want to work with this person because they're looking out for my best interest. The worst companies I ever worked for were the ones that looked at me and said, we can do that for you. And then when you hit a snag, when you invariably hit that pitfall, they were, well, this isn't what you wanted. You wanted this. You know, and I'm like, I'm looking for the person that can look out for me and make me successful. Don't just give me what I ask for. Give me what I need. And that's the key for me.
I think his answer is the trust. That really, when it comes down to it, all the other stuff is building trust.
Yeah, and that's where I wanted to get to. That is really critical. How many times have you, when you were making that big purchase, did you buy the more expensive provider? And why did you do it?
Trust the sales guy.
You trusted them. Mm-hmm. You trusted that they were going to deliver value beyond what you were paying for. Okay? And I think about my roof example. I got two quotes. I had a very specific need. I had no soffit in my roof. The roof came right to the edge of the house. Okay? Well, if you know anything about roofs, which I now know a little bit about roofs, you can't create airflow to take heat out of your attic space if you don't have some air coming in from that underside of the roof. So I shared that with two contractors, and I said, how do we resolve that issue? You know, I know you can put a fan at the top, but what does that really do? And one contractor came with a solution, and the other one didn't. I went with the one that we did. He was more money. And then when the other guy got back to me, I said, I already have a roof on my house. He goes, well, why didn't you call me? I said, well,
I told you the problem, and he offered a solution, and you didn't. He said, well, what was the solution? And I told him, and he said, well, I could have done that. I said, great. Well, why didn't you tell me when I told you the problem? Right? So that the reason we buy is that we have trust, we develop trust and respect for the knowledge, skill, and ability that these individuals are providing us. Okay? And I wanted to bring that out because if you go to a lot of sales training programs, one of the first things they'll tell you is you got to build rapport. Okay? And I remember the very first sales training program I was in North Jersey when I was 22 years old, and they said, oh, you know, you got to build rapport, so you go in the office and they have decoys, you go talk about decoys. I'm thinking to myself, what, you know, I'm a city kid, what do I know about decoys? You know, I didn't even know they were called decoys. They looked like ducks to me. Okay? And won't you know it, I go on my very first sales call, and the guy had decoys on the thing. And it was like, you couldn't orchestrate that, right? If I talked about decoys, is that sincere?
No.
No. It's a farce. Okay? So I'm gonna suggest something to you that I've learned, which I hope you'll think is profound, and that is, you're not here to make friends. The people you're selling to are not looking for friends. Okay? What they're looking for is an expert. Someone who can come and tell you how to solve problems that you don't have a solution for at that moment. Okay? Someone that can tell you, well, if you're going to do X, did you ever think of Y? And you said no. Well, maybe we need to be thinking about Y. Okay? That's who you want on your team. Because really what you're building is an extension of your team. They just don't have an employee number and get a payroll check from your company. That's the difference, right? A good consultant is an extension of the organization that that you're representing, right? So, and I say this because almost every training program talks about building rapport. And the number one reason that people buy is trust and respect, which has nothing to do with rapport. Okay? Has nothing to do with friendship. Now, I know a few of you in the room are probably very strong social animals, and, you know, for you, it is about the friendship. Okay? But trust me when I tell you, for most of your customers, it's not.
I dispute that.
Okay.
All right.
Good.
It's how you define friends. I'm not coming over for a beer. I'm not coming to your house.
That's how I define friends.
All right. Now, if you want to take another term, the trusted advisor. All right. If I'm going to be a trusted advisor, I have to actually be a friend in terms of breaking down some barriers so I can talk to you and tell you what keeps me awake at night. Because if I don't tell you what keeps me awake at night, then you can't see where my problems are. You can't start to develop a relationship with me that I'm empathetic, that I've walked in your shoes, I know people walk in shoes. If you don't do that,
right, but
you'll never get over that wall.
But I don't have to create phony friendship in order to get you to reveal that information to me.
It depends on how you define friends. Mm-hmm. Because you have a dichotomy there where you have a personal friend and a professional friend. And they can be totally different people and totally different approaches.
Well, I would agree that long-term relationships in business can materialize into friendship. I absolutely agree with that. I think in the short term of an early part of the sales process, it's not about creating friendships. Now, I agree with you. I have to do something as a sales professional to be able to get you to trust me so that you will reveal what keeps you up at night. And if I don't do that, I will fail. I totally agree with you, okay? But it's not about an artificial bonding that I'm going to create with you that says, well, I'm into biking and you're in biking, so all of a sudden we have a connection. Because guess what? If I'm in biking and you're not, then we might not have a connection.
Yeah, but you see, you're just taking it from one perspective. I'm in business and you're in business.
That's correct.
All right? So as a friend in business, right, we have issues and problems that are common to us. Because if our business isn't in pain, then we're probably not growing. right? So we can share that level of camaraderie and friendship to look at those issues, discover what those things are, to keep in our wake up where my pain is. And that's it now.
So how do you, because you're in sales, right?
We're all in sales, yeah.
I couldn't have said it any better myself, okay? So how do you get your prospective customers to share what to create that environment that makes them comfortable so that they will share what keeps them up at night?
I will talk. I will not even talk about what I do right away. How's your day going? I will ask, just ask that question. Well, what's going on? How's business? How's things going? How are you treating? All that kind of stuff. Just to get them to talk about their business, what they're doing, what keeps them up at night.
Okay.
I will ask that question.
Is there anybody in the room that approach would be like, you're wasting my time, you know, let's get to... Okay, so for somebody, that approach would come across as, you know, what's the point here? Okay, and I'm not saying it doesn't work. I'm just saying that method may not work all the time.
Well, and actually, it's also really specific to companies and to cultures. I can tell you, when I deal with the Swiss could not give a crap about me personally or even having me as a friend. Whereas when I deal with the South Americans want to establish a relationship before we even do business.
Right.
And companies are the same way, and so are people.
Yeah.
So how do you create relationships in South America?
Yeah, and the bottom line is, you know, in South America, you create the relationships by talking to them, finding out about their families, going out to dinner with them, having drinks with them. But none of that would work in Germany or Switzerland or with your German or Swiss colleagues. You know, some people, I see where you're coming from, but I look at it a different way. I came from the farm industry, and I saw great friendships totally destroyed because the company demanded of an employee something where they had to screw their you know, vendor. And they could have had the greatest friendship in the world where they were fishing together. But the truth is, in the long run, that entire relationship and eventually the sale just disappeared because each year the company said, we need you to go 2% lower on your margin. 2% lower, 2% lower, 2%. And then finally they said, we can't support you.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, you know what?
If it's not a win-win, why am I in this game?
Are we going to the baseball game together on Friday night? It's like, screw you. You just lost me the account. So I kind of see it from both your perspectives. It's just, I think it's more on the trust side. And for you, the friendship really is about the trust.
Yeah, because then let's take your example. You're asking for more gives back, more give back, more give back. All right? Well, if you don't have that trust and you don't have the relationship, they'll just say, well, you're just trying to screw me, right? But if the way you present it to them, the way you talk to them, they understand your position in the nature of the industry, you know, chances are, you know, if you've got that kind of relationship, it may not go to the hopper, right? It may go to say, hey, you know what? That's the cost of doing business. Guess what? I'll move on to somewhere else. You know, maybe I'll double back a couple of years. Things will change, right? But see, that's not a personal, like, that's a business relationship. That's a business relationship. I mean, you know, I could go back 20 years, and I might not have talked to the guy for 12 of them, right? But in the most recent 12, I think, case in point, he knows me. We did a lot of work. We're friends. I never went to a baseball game with him, never went to a bar with him. But, boom, you know, get on the phone like I talked to him yesterday.
I'd like to expand my statement a little bit.
Yeah, please do.
And that is that if you, I ask people for money for no return except personal happiness.
Well, that's
and
not nothing.
But they don't know that necessarily when I approach them.
See, my wife's in fundraising, so I actually don't agree with that. But go ahead. I think they get a lot out of it.
I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't think
right, about it.
Right, okay. That's good. Absolutely true. But when you first approach somebody, they may not be philanthropic.
That's
they correct. May not think there's any value at all in giving money for nothing.
Right.
So if I think that if you spend more than about 45 seconds on the how's the weather today, you know, what's going on in your life, without immediately bringing in your value proposition, and I mean that in a very short period of time. I mean a short value proposition. Why are you there? Why are you taking up my time? And by giving that and getting a positive response to it and building on that, then you earn the right to get that other kind of relationship. And you may earn that right within an hour, or you may earn that right within 15 minutes. But I think if you don't bring that value proposition to the table fairly quickly,
they're off in another land because they're busy. They have lives to live and businesses to run.
And actually, as you climb the chain, the amount of time you have to deliver your value prop diminishes exponentially.
Absolutely.
Especially in the larger organizations.
Absolutely.
Yep.
When you're dealing with the C-level, you have like seconds. They have the attention span of a hat.
So when we look at the challenges and the successes, we need to keep in mind that we're talking about a lot of different things that go into what we would call a sales funnel. Okay. So gaining the initial attention, all right, could potentially be actually outside the funnel, right? Because they haven't said, yes, I want to engage in dialogue yet. Okay. So once they say, yes, I want to engage dialogue, we then can start to put them in the funnel. And once they're in the funnel, then there's some level of trust and respect or, in your case, friendship that has to be created. And we're not going to let this one, we're going to talk about this some more in a second, that goes on, that is needed to move down here. And the more trust and respect you gain, the more time you get, okay? So early on, you don't get a lot necessarily, but as you develop trust and respect, the more and more time you'll get in a phone conversation, in a direct meeting, whatever the case may be. So since I am a behavioral analyst and we did want to talk about how that can impact the selling process, I did want to address this one, which is know your client, know your customer, okay? So what I have here is a short form. There's four at that table. A short form that I'm going to go through with everybody. In order to understand others, you've got to first understand yourself, right? So we're going to go through this together. And it won't take us very long. Dave, you're going to do this too. So if you open this up, who would like to read step one for us out loud?
I'm happy to.
Dave said he's going to do it, so Dave's doing it.
Step one, before you begin this survey, take a moment and imagine how you would prefer to be at work. If you could just be yourself at work, then read the statements below and rank them in order using the scale in step two. Don't overanalyze, go with your gut instinct. By the end of the exercise, you'll be able to identify your behavior style and learn how this knowledge will prove to be valuable in selling and communicating with others.
Who wants to read the instructions on step two on the side left margin?
Someone already volunteered for that?
Yeah, he did raise his hand, by the way. I didn't just call on him.
All right, reading from left to right, rank the phrases across each row on a scale from 1 to 4 on how accurately each phrase describes your normal behavior. 1, rarely like me. 2, somewhat like me. 3, usually like me. And 4, very much like me.
Okay, so everybody understand the instructions? I'm going to simplify it, I hope, even more. So this is how I do these things, all right? You read the four things across line 1, and you say, which is most like me? Gets a 4. Which is least like me? Gets a 1. So you just knocked out half of them, right? Then you read the other two again, and you say, well, which is most like me? Gets a 3. Which one's least like me? Gets a 2. And you're done, and you move on to the next one, all right? This should take you no time at all to get through. This truly is a gut response that we're looking for. And then step 3 is you're going to literally add the numbers up in each one of the columns. And I know that for some of you, it'll be very easy. And for some of you, you might need your calculators. Okay? And that's okay. So take a couple minutes and do this now. Once you're done adding them up, whichever one is the highest, you can read the corresponding description on the very next page on section 4. And if you have two that are pretty close, you could read both of them because they are going to be both relevant. Right. Ultimately, I'm going to try and simplify it so that people can, without that planner, can in the moment do it.
I love this. This is so much better than the Myers-Briggs.
I personally agree. Why do you feel that is?
I think, number one, Myers-Briggs is too complex. And so if you're in a meeting with somebody, if you're spending time analyzing across 8 different kinds of,
right.
or 12,
right.
I guess.
I think it's 16
personality points.
Yeah.
You're going to miss what's going on, and you're not going to be asking the right questions.
It's funny. I agree with you for that exact reason. I'm all about, if it's simple, I can use it. If it's not, it's just, I get lost. And part of it is because I'm a dominant, so if I can't do it quickly, you know, I'm not going to do it. Now, that's good and bad. I mean, I know that about myself, right? But I always feel that if what we're doing is actionable, then we're going to get results. Back to what we were talking about before, just because I gave you an idea doesn't mean you're going to be successful using it, right?
I think the funniest thing I ever heard was somebody that absolutely does the Myers-Briggs. They actually kind of live their life according to the Myers-Briggs. And one of the things they asked me one time when I told them the idea of the MBTI was it administered by a true certified professional?
Oh, my goodness.
So it's like, oh, my God, now we're at, you know, complexity on top of complexity. And, and it's like, well, you know, isn't it just a tool? Don't you use all your tools in the toolbox to kind of fix the faucet? You
know? Well, there is some benefit to that. Because just because I have a plumber's wrench doesn't mean I'm a certified plumber. and I may not know where to use that plumber's wrench properly, right?
But as a plumber, if you just use your wrench, how do you unscrew the top of the faucet?
Well,
you can knock it off really easily, and then you have an unworking thing. So my comment is, it's just one tool in
absolutely
your toolbox. So
the benefit of any certificate, doesn't matter what you do, is a greater, deeper level of understanding. That's basically at the end of the day what we're talking about. Doesn't matter if you're an accountant or a doctor. I mean, that's what it is.
Are you a do-it-yourself?
No.
There you go.
Yeah, I do it myself. I write the checks. Actually, I don't even do that. I've delegated that part too.
It's a beautiful thing.
I make the decisions and delegate the check writing. Everybody completed? Anybody need a little more time? All right, so by show of hands, whose number one highest score was the first column, which is direct and decisive? Okay? By a show of hands, who number one was outgoing and optimistic? I knew that. All right, by a show of hands, whose was accommodating and steady? One, okay. That's your number one? Okay, and by a show of hands, number one, conscientious and precise.
Wow.
Figured that out when I first met you. All right, so.
Applied science, engineering.
Okay, now who had a second one that was not the exact high, but, you know, also pretty high? And yours was?
It's only 2 points away, direct and decisive.
Yeah, that I could have figured
outgoing
out.
Optimistic.
Is your optimistic?
Outgoing optimistic.
Same. Was yours outgoing optimistic?
No, mine was conscientious and precise.
Oh, interesting, interesting. Okay, so this is a quick and dirty version of this. Okay, that's what this is. How accurate were the descriptions when you read the descriptions? You know, it's a simple description. Obviously, there's a lot more complexity that we can add to this, but it's a simple description, okay? And what I'm going to do, if you go to the back side, you have a little bit of a more detail about each one of these. God bless you.
Thank you.
We're all different, correct? But if we have similar, what I would call dominant behavioral styles, we can be somewhat predictable in how we're going to behave in certain situations. All right? And that's really the power of this. The key that I like to tell people is you are not this. Whatever you defined, you know, as being your number one, it's not who you are. It may be how you present yourself to the outside world, but it doesn't define you as a human being. Okay? And I think that's an important distinction I like to make for people. So that's the number one thing. It's what I would call behavioral tendencies. Yes?
I teach a program called Social Status. This is it. And I was curious as I was filling out mine where I was going to fall, fell right into my particular social style. Mm-hmm. What you just said is important, because what we talk about in social style is it's how other people perceive you. You can also use this, you're probably going there, as a way that you could begin to look at other people and try to figure out where they fall here.
Yeah, and what's the benefit of identifying other people?
We call it versatility. So you know where you need to flex. So we were talking earlier, it may be with some customers a more personal approach.
Right.
Or other customers, I can tell you, the more personal approach is going to fall into
right side here.
Right.
Whereas a less personal approach is going to fall on the other side.
Right.
So if you can identify where they are, you know where to go.
All right, so let's do that a little bit. So take this document. I'm not going to have you read all these details because you can do that on your own, okay? But if you draw a horizontal line right between the two, okay, cut this page in half, the people above the line behaviorally are going to be like me, outgoing, energetic. Have I stood still a lot? No, it's impossible for me to stand still. It's literally impossible. It is one of the most uncomfortable things you could do to me. It is a form of torture for me, is to make me stand still. Okay? So if you are engaging in dialogue with somebody who's very animated, vocal, energetic, outgoing, you know, all these things, right away you can draw that line and you're gonna say their dominant behavioral characteristic is either the D, dominant, or the I, the influencer. Okay? So it's an either or. We're doing a process of elimination, which goes back to the comment you made earlier. I can do that like this, right? It becomes very actionable. It doesn't take a lot of effort. Okay, because the people below the line, okay, you two guys, are more methodical. Slow is not the right word, but you're more contemplative in how you do things. Okay? You're going to be the one, and you just did it, sitting there kind of thinking, you know, you're the thinkers. You know, you're taking the time to absorb the information and be, in fact, your behavior is going to be very different than him because you're going to be, you don't want to play poker with him. Am I right? Because people over here, they tend to be non-emotional. That doesn't mean they don't have any emotion. That means they don't show their emotion. Me, I wear it on my sleeve. It's, you know, overflowing. That's not that way for you, okay? And really good poker players, you have no idea how they're feeling. You know, where me, I'm going to be gleeing when I have two aces in my hand. You know, I'm going to put all in right from the beginning because I don't know anything about poker, and I know two aces is good, right? Okay? The difference, while you're not going to show the same level of emotion, he's going to be more questioning, right? So what you're going to do is you're going to be very, not truly judgmental, but you're thinking about all the questions because you need to understand things, all right? And I'm not going to get his trust until I can demonstrate to him that I know what I'm talking about. And until I do, I'm not going to earn your trust. Is that accurate?
True.
Okay? Because somebody with his behavioral style is it going to be in a sales process, even if they're a donor, is going to want to get into all the details. Where's the money going? How much goes to overhead? You know, all the details of where does this go? What do they do with the money? You know, I don't want to just know what organization it goes to. I want to know exactly whose hand it gets put into. Okay? Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but if she understands that, she can now take that person and give them what they need to make them feel comfortable. And if she does that, do you think she will get their money? I say yes, only if they're aligned with the mission. And they wouldn't have gone into that level of conversation if they weren't already aligned with the mission. Because if they weren't aligned with the mission, they would have said no a long time ago. Okay, is it easy for you to say no?
Yes.
Is it easy for you to say no? Okay, that's a qualification which in my world is a no, right? Yeah. It's not as easy because, yeah, I mean, you will, but you don't want to hurt people's feelings. Where you're just like, it's business. It's yes or no, right? Okay, I don't like what you're offering, no. Okay, difference between these two. Now, for those that are high D, is it easy for you to say no? Dominant? Is it hard for you to say no?
No?
No, you do it like that. How about my eyes in the room? Is it easy?
It's tougher.
Okay?
Except if you have a backup D, so.
And why is it tougher? It does, but why is it tougher? Because we tend to be the higher eyes or the influencers. We feel, the higher eyes fear social rejection. So why would I reject you if I fear myself? Okay? All right? Why is that relevant? If I'm selling to somebody like that, A, they're not going to be as direct in their responses to me, and B, they're going to be afraid to say no. Is this something you want? And they're going to be afraid to say no.
I wouldn't use the term afraid.
Well, reluctant is the word. Reluctant. Thank you. You're right. You're right. Reluctant is the better word.
But the thing about the D's and I's, too, how you can spot them quickly is they almost all are interrupters. They'll finish your own sentence for you. They'll answer your question before you finish asking it. And even when they're accomplished and they've had all the training in the world, it still comes out. You know, so being good listeners, which is important in the sales process, is something they really have to learn.
They struggle with.
Where below the line are already good at that. Already good at that.
I had I'm currently in a conversations actually with a major sports organization, one of the top four. And I went through the whole thing, and I do give some of my services away. And the person was identified as a high S, you know, and we got into a whole lot of dialogue, and he's, you know, engaging me, and we're moving the sales process forward. I'm making progress. And at one point in time, he says to me, "So, you know, I'm a certified Myers-Briggs trainer." I was like, "Really?" He said, "Did I tell you that before?" I said, "A, no, and B, I'm not surprised you didn't tell me." Because behaviorally, they're going to keep things close to the vest. But what did I know I had at the point which he shared with me?
Trust.
Yep. Okay, I had credibility in his mind. I had a high hurdle I didn't even know was there. Okay, until I was deep into the sales process, because I'm selling to somebody who's going to keep those things tight to the vest. Okay, and when he's willing, now, would he have shared that in the first meeting with him, no matter how many questions I asked? Probably not. Okay, not because he didn't think it was relevant, but because certain things, behaviorally, that type of individual is going to keep to themselves until they feel comfortable releasing that information. Vertical line, okay? Vertical line, the people on the left are task-oriented. The people on the right are people-oriented. Okay?
This is the dispatch.
Right. Yes. Right. So, now what I'm giving you, and we're going to go through in a little bit greater detail, is I've given you a simple, now remember, nobody is anything. This isn't who they are. This describes how they behave. So as you're working to assess their preferred behavioral pattern, and that is the key word, preferred behavioral pattern, your goal or objective there is to be a better salesperson / communicator as a result of understanding them better. That is your goal. Nothing more, nothing less. Okay? Now, there's our natural behavioral style, and as I like to say, it's when we get up in the morning, it's like who we are, how we behave. And then there is the adapted style. So if you think about it, I can't adapt my behavior if I don't first understand my behavior. Okay? So the benefit of you doing the little exercise you did to identify your own personal behavioral pattern or natural behavioral pattern was that when you can understand yourself, you're now in a better position to understand others. All right? And so I provided this second sheet, which is the customer style identification chart, to actually break down each of the behavioral styles and give you a dominant or a view of how they perceive things. Okay? Now remember, they could be adapting their behavior when you're trying to assess their behavioral style. Okay? It's not, some people do it, but not everyone. Okay? But the power from a sales perspective, when we're in the moment, okay, of working with people, and I'm talking about being on the phone, in any kind of extended dialogue, any kind, to me, which is like more than 3 minutes. Right, because if I get off within the first 2 minutes, I mean, it's usually because, and the way I do it, some of the people are asking, I make an offer. you know, this is what I do. Is this something you want? Very direct question, right? Yes or no. And if they say maybe, I already have an indication of some indication of their preferred behavioral style. Okay? Because my C's in the room and my D's in the room, when I ask them that question, it's a yes or no question. It's either yes, I'm interested in what you're telling me, or no, I'm not. And they're going to answer the question with a yes or no. More than likely, yes.
I was going to say, this is very important, when you, especially when you're dealing with customers, say, with email. Because I'm a D, and so I just get to the point.
Right.
But people get my emails, and they think, oh, it's like in their face.
Yes.
So before I send it, I go and have the pleases and the, you know, have a nice day. Right. All those things, I'm just like, yeah, just, nice weekend. And I just, you know, I just want to...
I worked in technology in the software industry for over a dozen years, and the founder of our company, which is a large company, used to talk about how he didn't put his kids in front of computers at a young age, which is contrary, of course, to what everybody was doing. And the reason, he said, is because it thwarts people's communication skills, which is true. So my philosophy is email is an information tool, not a communication tool. So if I want to inform you of something, or if I want to request a meeting or something like that, I use email. I do not use email to communicate. I use the phone or face-to-face meetings. Now, it is hard. You're doing business overseas. You're doing virtual. You know, people are far, far away. There's other challenges. But it is really difficult to communicate a message effectively in email in comparison to voice and face-to-face, because face-to-face, of course, is the best because you got body language, you got eye contact, you got all these things that are so valuable. And voice, at least I have tone, right, that I can take tone. If I ask a question and I get silence, I lose that.
Over the phone and you've got an Australian accent, forget it.
Why?
Because people don't understand me over the phone.
Well, then you have to work harder at it.
I've only been here for 20 years.
But here's the other piece that you have to be careful of. The Gen X's and the Gen Y's,
yes.
They do not agree with your statement.
I understand. I understand. That doesn't make them right.
Yeah.
Listen, I deal with them smoking like a true D. Very good, because that's what a D would say. And that's what this is about. We leave clues like this. We drop them all the time. Our job is to be able to recognize them so that we can sell to them. Okay? It's simple if you're looking for the clues. It can be one word, one statement. Okay? It was obvious. Okay? But guess what? I do know that younger people today, it's nearly impossible. And I'm talking under or college age or under. It's nearly impossible for them to face-to-face ask somebody out on a date. And guess what? That is a problem.
I had a discussion on Tuesday with the CEO of estate planning financial service company. And we got into that discussion, and he's starting to see it now, people he's hired, is that they cannot carry on a conversation.
Yes.
Right? And, you know, that's where his pain is, because in his business, you need to be able to talk.
Listen,
we raised a whole generation that cannot carry on.
It doesn't matter your business. We have a highly technical individual here. If he can't sell his ideas, right, you're going to be hungry.
Right.
Okay? It doesn't matter. You're an accountant, which we typically view as a technical expertise at some level. Okay? If you can't sell your concept or ideas, you're not going to eat. Okay? It doesn't matter what we do. Okay, it doesn't matter whether we're independent consultants. Our ability to rise up in the organization is directly correlated to our not just our ability to perform, but our ability to communicate internally in the organization or externally if we need to, you know, communicate externally. They're directly linked. You know, there's a saying that says the person who can communicate the best is the person who's going to rise to the top. Not change just because we got new electronic medium. Okay? That's what they don't realize yet. And that's why I say that's what they believe. Okay? Just because there's new technology doesn't mean we transform the old way we do things to new technology. Okay? I have the view that each of these has a purpose. They're not all the same. The purpose. Okay? This doesn't replace email. It does a little bit. But can I write a long email on this?
No.
No. I mean, I could, but it would be laborious. Right? And with the size of my thumbs, it really is tough. Okay? Okay. So what do we end up doing? We write short, quick messages. Unless I'm sitting in the airport and I'm waiting for a plane, I got nothing better to do. Okay? Then I could type a long email. But that's the exception, not the rule. Okay? Can I write more in this than people text? Yes. Which is why people text like very short. You know, that's where the whole abbreviation thing came out. Now I don't even have to write it out. I can just write three initials and you know what I'm thinking. Okay, so my point is that all of this, that we, the inputs we get, is a form of triggers to help us understand the type of individual, back to this knowing your customer, that you're dealing with. So let's go through this. Buying issue, all right? And I'm going to ask the people in the room, my deep people, you guys care about price, correct? And value. Doesn't mean you won't pay a premium. You'll pay a premium, won't you? But the perception is that you're getting value. Okay? My eyes in the room, you're focused on how it's going to impact the people, right? When you buy something. All right? The S's are focused on the product. I was selling to a guy at Comcast. The very first meeting, he hasn't even said, yeah, I want to do this. And he's asking me for references. All right? He wants a proven something. And in some way, shape, or form, he believes that if I give him a good reference, it validates that what I do works. Because the people that are high on the S scale aren't big risk takers. They like things the way they are. They want to know it's a proven thing, whatever that is, if I'm buying it. Okay? How often are you the first one to buy the latest new gadget whiz bang? You're not. You're going to wait and figure out which one's proven, and once it's proven, you'll happily buy it.
And watch the price go down.
And watch the price go down, too. And you're focused on the problems, right? How can we fix this? If it fixes it, I'm interested. If it doesn't, and price is secondary.
Yeah.
It has to work first. Then we'll talk about price.
Yeah.
Okay?
Then you go to the cheapest.
But is the cheapest always best? No, and you know that too, right? You'll pay more if you believe that you're getting better quality. Okay? Emotional state. This goes back to my conversation earlier on. Those high Ds are not going to give us the time necessarily. They're going to be impatient. Get to the point, right? The eyes, we tend to at times be like, what are you talking about? You know, because we're too scattered at times when we're the eyes. You know, we have a lot going on.
But I don't know if confused is kind of what you can put there.
It can come across that way at times. The people that are S are going to be concerned. The people that are C are going to be suspicious. So they're looking for information to validate what you're telling me. And until I get that information, I'm not sold. All right?
Now, the fun part in this comes where you actually have like a D and a C together in a room at the same bid defense or while you're trying to go ahead and get business.
Well, this is, and you said you were a D and C, right?
No, I'm a DI.
Oh, you were a DI.
Yeah,
you are a
DI.
Okay, I thought you said you were
a
DC.
I'm a drill instructor, you know, pound.
No, I thought you said you were a DC before.
I'm sorry, I am a CS.
A DC.
I'm sorry, I am a DC.
Okay. All right, so you brought out an interesting point. What are Ds focused on? What are Ds results? What are Cs focused on?
Results.
Okay. Ds do it. They're very with a great sense of urgency. Cs are perfectionists, right? They want to make sure everything's right. Give me more time. I need to make a combination of a DC can really be tough to please. I'm sure if you asked your wife, she might confirm that.
Actually, it's funny.
Actually, there is no wife.
Was there a wife? Was there a wife?
Close.
How about children? Did you have children?
No.
Okay. But I have a friend that's at D.C., and we've talked about it, and it's really hard for his kids to live up to his standards.
Well, I'm the wife of a D.C.
Okay.
And imagine how much D I have. Anybody that knows me? Like, how about less than nothing? It's on the minus level. That's why y'all are my friends.
She's a high eye, in case you didn't figure
it out. High eye. Scary, off the charts high eye. But one of the things is, in a lot of ways, if you do befriend and get to know a DC and keep them in your life, then that becomes your practice ground for moving on to clients, people that will actually pay you.
The truth of the matter is, I could predict based upon your behavioral style pretty solidly the type of person that you're married to.
No, really, that's interesting.
And the not with 100%, but pretty significant. Why do you think that is? Opposites back to what you said. Opposites attract. Why do we do that? We tend to complete us. Yes. Right? If I'm not dominant, right, I need somebody in my life who is.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I'm... And it's so unconscious. You know, we don't think that way when we're 22 or 28 years old looking for a spouse, but that's how we behave. Okay?
And I think what
Rebecca
said.
The what?
The
highest divorce rate.
That I wouldn't go into. But
it is with DC. No, I'm kidding.
So,
they're very tough bosses to work with.
So, negative characteristics. This is an important one. Negative characteristics.
What
so,
does that mean?
Well, so we look at D. We look at D, okay? Is a D going to have a tendency in a meeting to dominate it?
Yes.
Is that always the best way?
Yes.
And it doesn't matter whether it's a sales call or not, right? But in a sales meeting, they're going to say, get to the point, give me this, give me that, boom, boom, boom. And they're going to, you had a whole plan of what you were going to do, and they're taking it down their path. Okay? You better expect that. Okay? Because if you don't expect it, and you know that they're a D, you're going to be really sidetracked. And you're going to walk out of that meeting and say, that was a terrible meeting. Because I didn't achieve any kind of objective that I wanted because they took over the meeting. And I couldn't control the meeting because I was no longer the one asking the questions. Because our D's and our C's are the ones that are going to be asking the questions. The C's, of course, are going to be the ones that are asking all the detail and technical questions, and they want all the specifications and stuff like that. And guess what? If I'm not prepared for that, if I don't have it, if I don't provide it to the degree that he or she wants, then I have no trust and credibility with them. Yes?
Some of us sell to HR or training people. Do you see that in certain professions they're more of a certain personality type?
These are behavioral patterns, not personality
types.
Well,
I should say, sorry.
Okay. It's an important distinction. And the answer is generally yes, but you need to be careful about that. Mm-hmm. Who generally is attracted to HR? What yeah, behavioral types? Look
see,
on here.
See?
See? S's.
S
might be.
I's and S's.
I's and S's because they're people oriented. Okay.
They're rule oriented.
What's that?
They're rule oriented.
Who's rules oriented?
I think HR.
HR.
HR, the interesting part about it, but yes and no. See, here's the challenge of this one, and this is a great point. What attracts people to HR is the ability to positively impact human beings, right?
Right.
But what they fail to realize early on is that HR is about compliance.
Yes. Right.
Okay.
Compliance.
To a large degree. There's no exclusiveness.
That's the way it used to be.
But I agree. You don't have no
and it depends on the organization and your role within the HR.
Yeah,
but
I think that's what you want to do.
It could be a city.
Corporations.
And that's why I say you got to be careful, okay? Generally speaking, it does attract people-oriented people, generally speaking. Now, it may be shifting because of the compliance nature of HR or certain aspects of HR that are compliance-driven, okay? Because all of HR is not all compliance-driven.
Plus, a lot of HR functions in the olden days are now at the line management responsibility. They're now back with line management.
Right.
And that's how they're reducing work headcount, right? In HR, we're putting more responsibilities back on the line manager, and the HR function becomes a support role to those people.
And also, don't forget, HR deals directly with the legal department.
Yes.
And that makes them more of a C than anything else.
Well, yes and no, okay? The legal department could provide the C, the detail, the analytical needed for them to do their job. They don't necessarily have to have the skills to do their job, those components, because they have a resource to help them, okay? So that's a fine balance that you want to talk about.
You're talking in a corporation that works positively that way. In most places, they throw it over the wall.
In fundraising, okay, if we do endowment planning, okay, there's a large legal aspect to that, right?
Yeah.
So the people who are experts in endowment tend to be more legal-oriented. If they don't have a law degree, which many of them do, okay, they have a high degree of understanding around that arena because it's required in that level of donations and funding. Okay, so again, it's like any other business, you know, you can cut any job classification into very narrow slivers, and the level of competence, skills, and ability needed to perform that can be very different even though you're in the same larger organization like HR or fundraising. Okay.
To the point you made earlier, you're still going to have some of each one of these. Corporation.
Every person.
Every job.
Every person.
Right?
Did anybody get a zero on any of these? No. Okay. Nobody got a zero. So each of us has a little bit of it.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's an important distinction to make. And why, when you're selling to groups of people, it's even more important to understand, well, what is the role of it? You know, and we talk about in selling that somebody's there to be, somebody usually is the coach, you know, is kind of helping you through the sales process. Somebody's the decision maker. Somebody else may be the analytical person who may be looking into the details. Do you really know and understand QuickBooks? And do they provide the level of technical knowledge we need? Those people tend in that decision, that group decision-making process, to be the people that can say no, but they can't say yes. So they give the green, they're influencers, because they can give the green light. Okay, this person or organization passes muster, but you know they're going to deliver for us. They know what they're talking about, but they're not the person that necessarily says yes. Okay, so when you get into these group discussions, it's really important to understand what different roles are and what their role is in the broader decision-making process.
There's another whole aspect of this, which is creating high-performing teams, because you're also talking to that as well. You even said it's
my business.
Well, and ultimately, the bottom line is you're looking for complementary styles. I think the best thing that I ever heard was successful companies typically have three people: the visionary, the operations person, and the salesperson. You know, and sometimes they're in the same person, but it's rare.
Right.
You know, and in these situations, when I see, you know, if I'm an I, then, yeah, I'm looking for the C's, the S's, you know, and I tend to be I and D. But, you know, what's your point, it also gets us in that general direction. I mean, your comment is, interesting enough, almost in a perfect world. I've rarely seen the organizations where legal and HR work well together. I've rarely seen the situations where you wind up in a room where you have a D that is willing to listen to the other opinions in the room to go ahead and make a decision for the corporation. You know, and when you find those companies, exactly, they've already made the decision, and this person that could be sitting there like the C or the S going, hey, have we thought of this?
But that's the true leader. You'll find the higher you get in the organization, the more they actually do that. Did anybody read the article about Alan Mulally and Ford in Fortune magazine in the last, I think it was in May? I encourage you to read it. I've done a lot of work with Boeing. Alan Mulally is a former Boeing executive, left Boeing after he did not get the CEO job at Boeing, and took over Ford. And, of course, when he took over, they all said, oh, it's ridiculous. He'll never succeed because he's not a car guy. And what's the irony that of all the three companies, their company is the only one that didn't take money from you and I, right, to keep the company afloat. And part of that is he's a marketing genius, but there's some great dialogue in that article where he talks about how he changed the culture in the executive suite, okay, because he would have his, you know, leadership team, let's say it was all of us, in there and say, okay, what's not working? No one said anything. He looked at him and goes, listen, there's no way nothing's not working. I don't believe it. Okay? If there isn't nothing working, then why aren't our sales better? Why isn't everything better? right? You're either lying to me or you're lying to yourself. And the courage was the first person to say, oh, we're behind on this, we're behind on this. He changed the culture just in that executive suite because he was asking questions and expecting people to tell the truth. Okay? So we can't fix something we don't know. Okay? So we need to know. All right? And they totally changed the organization. Now, part of it is, you know, his brilliance is saying, listen, who are we? What are we going to do? And what he did that the other companies didn't do because of him is he jettisoned some of these extra brands that they bought years earlier, earlier than everybody else, so he got greater value from them. And they also built up a big lines of credit before all the problems happened, which is why they're in the position that they're in. So
there's another great story about the actually now the general that's in charge of the theater over in Iraq. And he, when he was a two-star in charge of a division, he actually pulled his assistant division commander and he said, okay, we both just got here. We're going to have a staff meeting with all the colonels, you know, so here's what I want to do. I'm going to say something. Now, what I want you to do is I want you to challenge me on it. And he said, well, what are you going to say, sir? And he said, well, I'm going to say this. He goes, but I don't disagree with that because it's not the point. Challenge me on it. Question me on it. And they go into the staff meeting and the two-star actually says it. And the one-star looks at him and says, sir, you know, have you looked at that from a different perspective? Maybe we need to do it differently. And the two-star looked at him for a real long period of time. And the one-star is thinking, oh, God, my career's over. And the two-star said, you know, that's a really good point, and I'm glad you brought it up. And afterwards, when they got together again, he said, now the colonels are going to feel they can actually
question.
Have
input. Right.
They can question. They can make recommendations. And that changed the whole, and that division wound up being tremendous with regard to their maneuverability, and he wound up going down to 4 stars in charge of the theater.
Right.
He modeled it.
Exactly. Yeah. He absolutely modeled it. Yep.
We go in here and we talk about how they make decisions, their relationship with their money, what might kill the sale, and you can read all that. I'm not going to go into this. But this is interesting, the very bottom, referral factor, because we talked about getting referrals, that who's more likely to give you referrals. Okay, and this assumes that you do a great job for all of them, all right, because you're expected it. Why should I give you a referral? I paid you, you delivered, you know, you did what you said you were going to do, right? Yeah, thank you very much, goodbye, you know, kind of thing, and I'm oversimplifying it for fun and drama, but you understand what I'm saying. They're more reluctant to do it, because, you know, it was right for me. That doesn't mean it's going to be right for her, because I don't know her, the details of her situation. So because I don't know the details of her situation, how could I possibly refer him to her? That's how they might think, right? Okay, so now I'm going to throw you a little curveball. So the biggest challenge we have in selling is our natural behavioral pattern, our personal. Because I believe we bring our own biases, behaviors, prejudices into and insert into the sales process. If you only buy low price, how do you think you're going to charge a high price for your services? You're not. You're not going to be comfortable doing it. Okay? I use the word emote. We emote our objections. You brought the word objections out. So if I would have a certain objection in a buying process, I literally, not intentionally, but I can emote it into the conversation. And all of a sudden, and take a look, do the objections I get mirror the objections I would have? And if the answer is yes, it's not the customer that's the issue, it's you. That can be pretty frightening, right? You know, it's that look in the mirror. It's that look in the mirror. All right? So we need to be comfortable with what we're selling, what we're promoting, the price we're asking, the potential liabilities to what we're doing. Is everything we do going to be 100% all the time? And anybody that believes it is kidding themselves. So it's important to understand yourself from the perspective of knowing what you're bringing into the conversation non-consciously. Okay? For you, if you don't believe you have a tried and true solution, it's going to be tough selling. Because that's something that you require.
I actually want to add one thing, and it's like so brilliant that this was the conversation for today, because I have a client that I've actually sold to, and you know, I'm in delivery mode now, and we had a conversation yesterday, and he kept using the word problems. Is this going to solve my problem? Now, I don't use the word problem because, as a high I, it's only an adventure to find a solution. You know.
And so, what's his behavioral style? Don't look. What's his behavioral style?
He's so a C.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Because the D's buy solutions to problems.
Okay. Well, in this case,
because the C would have done the research to be able to, if he was part of the process.
But this is in the delivery
okay.
scenario. Because he couldn't put the whole picture yet together. He couldn't see the picture. Can't see the finished product. Well, hello, we're only at stage one, and there's like 12, okay?
But you need him.
Right. But here's...
But what can you do right now to help him work?
Here's where I'm going with this whole thing, is that I had to say to him yesterday, listen, we're not prepared to have the conversation. We're going to come back. We're going to have the conversation. I need to finish the deliverable at stage one. You're jumping up here to this stage. So let's come back. But what's really wonderful that having this conversation, I am now going to be more mindful when I have that conversation to come from his place. And understand, he keeps using the word problem, problem, problem. So I have to incorporate that in the conversation.
So let me
ask, take that problem away.
Let me ask a question. I forget your name, I'm sorry. Is it Dan?
Don. Yeah.
So if you were her customer who said, is it going to solve my problem? And she said, well, that's too early, whatever she just said, how would you feel about what she said? Be honest.
I tend to agree because she's got to learn more about my
But she's already sold the company, so she's now in delivery mode, and you're involved in, you weren't part of the sales process, you're now part of the delivery experience, and you have some questions and concerns, which would be appropriate, mm-hmm. and she now basically says, hold off, it's not time for me to address you. That's essentially what you said. How would you respond to that?
Yesterday's conversation, absolutely.
I would want her to respond.
Yeah, so you're not satisfied.
Suspicion.
And actually, your level of suspicion, thank you, probably just went up.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
But here's the interesting thing to that. I have no problem selling it because we did the due diligence. Okay, but what happens, he's already said, he's jumped 12 steps, like he's jumped already from here to here. And his issue, his concern is that he can't see the picture of the puzzle.
Picture.
He can't see the picture.
So what's your job then?
Right.
What is your job now?
I have to put the picture together. But here's the interesting thing. So we have step one. So what I have to do is like look at the solution already. Look at the outcome. That's step one. Look at the solution that this has provided to this particular problem. Step two is going to have this solution, so I can kind of, you know, pull this together for you so that you can see the outcome, you know, in a broader picture, but you won't see it physically until
all the steps are
finalized and delivered. Then we can physically see where all the picture, you know.
Last question, and then I'm going to wrap up. So, knowing what we just know about the situation, which is a small piece of information, what recommendations would you have for her to do at this point, in the moment, knowing that her customer now is actually more suspicious today than he was yesterday?
I would take him through the entire process, mm-hmm. from step to step, because that's what he's really looking for.
Right.
And in each step, right. say to him, do you think at this point this is getting to the issue?
Right.
Because that's getting to this is taken into account that you've already asked him more about his problem. You know, that's kind of a given.
So you need to understand his problem from his perspective, not from who you sold to.
Oh, yes.
That's
yes.
Right.
And then walking through the whole process.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you, actually, I can jump way over here. Best thing about this is, I did all this. He gets that he's jumped ahead. He gets that he needs to go through each step. And he's on vacation next week. So he says, you know what? When I come back, you're going to have this. This is why I hired you.
Okay, that's fine.
Good.
You know.
But if you really had gotten to the point where he was suspicious,
yeah.
The first thing I would do is pick up the phone or go see him in person and say, listen, I apologize, because clearly you have a concern that I did not address. Okay, so the first thing is you're just recognizing and acknowledging to him or her that you recognize that you didn't address their concern. And then just say, I want to take the time to better understand how you define the problem, okay, assuming that you hadn't already done that with them. Okay, and then say, okay, let me show you how what we're going to do is going to solve that problem. And make sure that he or she gets it. Right, and then when they get it, then you have the ability to just do your job. They're not going to get in your way at that point.
I thought he got it at the sales cycle, or so wouldn't have hired me.
So hopefully this provided some insight and some greater level of value for you in how to improve your selling. But the key is, and we talked about it before, it's execution. And I'll share one last thought, and I'll bring it into the Aussie model, because it did happen in Australia. Some performance experts studied swimmers from Australia. And what they learned is that the swimmers that focused on the scoreboard, i.e. the time that they were going to get in an Olympic event, were the ones that underperformed. Now you think, well, how could that possibly be? You know, it's about getting the best time. They learned that the swimmers that focused on three things were the most successful. Number one, they were focused on giving their best effort. It seems ridiculous. They never thought about the clock. They said, I'm going to go and do the best I possibly can. And their thinking was about that. Number two, I'm going to learn something from the experience. And number three, I'm going to be willing to make mistakes. Okay, ELM, E-L-M. Okay, effort, learn, and mistakes. And so what I share that with you is mastery, and that's what it comes from. Mastery comes from a willingness to put the effort out on what we've talked about, use it, okay? Learn from the experiences when you use it, be willing to make mistakes, and if you continually do that in a closed loop, right, effort, learn, and then make mistakes, and then modify the effort, learn some more, and make another mistake, you're going to get very, very powerful using this in your sales process. So I wish you well, and thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan. That was a great presentation.